Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Cody Marvin on behalf of Plaintiff. Plaintiff raises two arguments for reversing the ALJ's decision. The first is that the ALJ's residual functional capacity assessment was not supported by an accurate and logical bridge from the evidence to the conclusion. The second is that the ALJ rejected the opinion of Dr. Orris, who was her treating physician, without considering whether it was consistent with other notes from her treatment at Stroger Hospital.
So in terms of this treating physician issue, I take it your position is that, at least in a context like Stroger Hospital and this clinic she was going to, if Dr. Orris was the supervising physician, maybe he saw her personally sometimes, maybe he was the final signature other times, he nonetheless should count as the treating physician.
That's right. After Ms. Sweet had her stroke, she participated in therapy.
It's the Fantas Clinic?
The Fantas Clinic, yeah. So she was given free treatment for a period of a year at the Fantas Clinic. And through that, it appears that Dr. Orris was a supervisory physician.
And that's in the medical records. His name crops up.
His name does show up, yes. So she was going there at least monthly, sometimes more frequently for physical therapy.
And this is a clinic for indigent people?
Yes. Yes. And as I pointed out in the brief, Social Security ruling 96-7P explains that while even when a patient or a claimant goes to a clinic, those are still valuable records and should be considered. And our argument is that Dr. Orris's opinion was consistent with many of those records, especially the physical therapy records. It showed that she was significantly limited in her ability to stand and walk following the stroke. She had left-sided weakness. She had arthritis in the knees. And even the long-term goals for her at physical therapy were extremely limited. I think one of them was that she be able to walk a few blocks in the community with a cane with pain on a scale of 2 to 3 out of 10.
So she has the major stroke in December of 06 and then the TIA in April 07?
Yeah, that's right.
And is there any other stroke activity, or is that it?
No. No, those were the two strokes.
But then she falls down in May of 07.
That's right.
Mr. Marvin, could I ask you to try to narrow some of the issues here? Prior to this December 2006 stroke, she was working, 25 or so hours a week?
Between 20 and 24 hours a week.
So is there really a viable claim for disability prior to that December 2006 stroke?
Really, I think we're focusing on her condition after the stroke. It shows that her date last insured was 12/31 of 2006. She had the stroke earlier in the month. I think it was the 11th, December 11th of 2006. Mm-hmm. But even past the date last insured, she had a concurrent claim, so she would have been eligible for SSI benefits even after the date last insured.
Right, but we really don't need to spend a whole lot of time trying to evaluate her condition while she was still working 25 hours a week.
Right, I want to focus on that time after the stroke. So as regards to the residual functional capacity finding, the ALJ found that Ms. Sweet was capable of performing light work, meaning that she could stand and walk for more than 6 hours per day out of an eight-hour day. The evidence shows that she had arthritis in the knees. She had left foot drop as a result from her stroke, residual weakness on the left from the stroke. And on top of all of that, she was obese.
But let me just turn it around a little bit, because as usual in these cases, I can certainly see that there's evidence that would support the side that you're arguing for, that would support a finding of disability. On the other hand, the ALJ cites even post-December 06 evidence. So I'm looking just randomly at page 6 of the ALJ's opinion. There's a May 31, 2007 physical therapy progress note. Her range of motion and motor strength, this is down at the bottom of the page, were within functional limits. They tell her to use a walker because that'll be better But she still has good range of motion by June, her left-sided weakness. So in other words, the ALJ is looking at this mass of evidence and deciding which to place the most weight on. Why doesn't that provide substantial evidence for the ALJ's conclusions?
The problem with that, specifically with the note you noted there, is that she focuses on that evidence, but there are other notes within the same from the same visit that show that she had limitations. It says that she has pain, decreased strength, balance, and coordination, difficulty with ambulation. She was still having difficulty performing activities of daily living. She had decreased strength in her right and left lower extremities.
Somebody who's limited to using a walker pretty usually qualifies for disability benefits, don't they?
Well, I suppose it depends on the other factors, but that would be extremely limiting. And probably would keep a person from standing and walking for more than 6 hours during an eight-hour shift. In addition to that, the ALJ did not adequately account for Ms. Liu's limitations in using the hands. There was evidence that she had a lot of pain in the hands. She had several carpal tunnel surgeries.
She had three procedures, didn't she?
Yes.
Yeah.
And the evidence shows that she continued to have pain after those, after the procedures, and up through the time of the decision. So even post-stroke, there was evidence that she was complaining of pain in the hands frequently to the doctors.
Could I ask you about, Mr. Marvin, the Dr. Orris issue again?
Sure, yeah.
The ALJ... if I recall correctly, the hearing was about a week before a scheduled meeting, visit with Dr. Orris,
right.
And the ALJ wanted to get the reports on that. Dr. Orris fills out the form and says, I've been seeing her for a month.
Right.
Whose responsibility was it to spot that problem?
Well, at that point, the ALJ had a responsibility, if there was a conflict in the evidence, to recontact the doctor.
Doesn't the claimant have some degree of responsibility, one who's being represented who's at the end of the hearing, the big deal is we need to hear from Dr. Orris.
Sure, I suppose that is. But, one, this was submitted after the hearing, so there was no more hearing to discuss that. And second, Social Security ruling 96-5P says that if there is that kind of evidentiary problem, then the ALJ does have a duty to recontact the doctor to clarify.
But why would the ALJ have known that that was a conflict? I mean, it depends a little bit on what Dr. Orris means by saying I've been seeing her.
That's true. The point is that it
might not have realized that there was anything to be clarified.
It is a little unclear, but there were notes from May of 2007 from Dr. Orris that the ALJ noted and discussed in her decision.
Are these notes that the Dr. Orris signs off as a supervisor?
This was a visit directly with Dr. Orris, okay. Where he discussed her migraine issues. So that was from May of 2007. In addition to that,
I suggest maybe that's the month he's talking about. That's not clear either.
Well, another inconsistency is that at the hearing, the claimant said the first time she saw Dr. Orris was January 2007 after the stroke, and that she saw him monthly. So that was brought up directly to the ALJ at the time. So at that point, it was unclear, but based on what the claimant said, she had been seeing Dr. Orris a lot more, so that should have raised.
Well, are you saying that every time there's a discrepancy between medical records and a claimant's testimony, ALJ has to go back?
I'm not. But the problem here is that the ALJ directly relied on that. She didn't discuss any of this in the decision. She said, as per Dr. Orris' statement, he's only treated her for a month, and then she used that as the basis for her conclusion. But it wasn't clear from the testimony or the evidence. And the ALJ wasn't entitled to rely on that without trying to clarify.
Well, even if Dr. Orris doesn't qualify as a quote-unquote treating doctor, do you have a backup position that she should have at least taken his account more seriously as just one of the doctors who saw her?
I do. I think she should have considered all of the factors in 20 CFR 404.1527D, especially considering the consistency with the physical therapy notes and all of the notes from Surger Hospital that show they provide some basis for Dr. Orris' opinion, and she should have considered that and discussed, especially those physical therapy notes, okay, in accordance with that. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Kickoffer.
Good morning, Your Honors. If it may please the Court, my name is Kyle Kiekhafer, and I'm here on behalf of Commissioner of Social Security. I'd like to, I guess, sort of pick up where Appellant Counsel left off and clarify. Well, first of all, in the briefing, Counsel calls Dr. Orris' statement about treating this the appellant for 1 month a mistake of fact, and says that it's ambiguous in the record and the record's unclear. Our position is there's no real ambiguity, and there really wasn't a lot for the judge to have to the ALJ to follow up on in terms of how often or how frequently or how extensive Dr. Orris had treated or even supervised the appellant.
But I wasn't wholly persuaded by that, only insofar as she does testify that she's seen him more often than that, and I take it these medical records do include his signature, and then perhaps applying a little bit of common sense, something that's likely, you know, a high volume, not the world's most personal environment, you know, like the Fantas clinics, you know, it seemed to me that it was possibly a mistake of fact. I couldn't rule it out. I don't know if it was, but, you know, it seems to me entirely plausible in those circumstances.
Well, as Judge Hamilton pointed out at the end of the hearing, there was discussions about trying to get a hold of Dr. Orris' records. And appellant's counsel at the time submitted a cover letter, you know, a week after the hearing with Dr. Orris' records and an opinion from Dr. Orris, the opinion that's sort of in dispute with the one-month statement. And attached to that were only, you know, I believe a total of 9 pages. One appeared to be a questionnaire from a different doctor, not necessarily an opinion, Dr. Orris' opinion, and then I believe it was lab results from a pap smear that had happened in February. And that pap smear is also referenced earlier in the record, and that's the only that's the only other time that I've seen Dr. Orris' name on anything. So you have one time in May that he actually saw the appellant, and one time in February with his name authorizing a pap smear. And it's unclear whether he even saw her that day, whether somebody else simply needed to come to him for authorization of a pap smear for insurance purposes.
But I assure you he's responsible from the point of view of medical malpractice or whatever else. If he puts his name on that record, he is in the game.
Sure, in terms of authorizing a pap smear. And
or in other ways. I mean, I guess...
I mean, I could be wrong, but I tried to comb the record rather closely and only saw his name those two times. Not even on the various times that she had gone for physical therapy, which by my count was one time in February, one time in March, a couple of times in May, and maybe one time in June, if I recall correctly. Also, I wanted to follow up. It seems to me that Appellant's counsel has here conceded that before December of 2006, she probably was not disabled. And all of the hand evidence, you know, comes before that period. And I'd like to just briefly walk the court through the timeline of December 2006.
But before you get to that, let's focus a little. If we put Orris' testimony aside.
Sure.
For a minute, or at least the records and the issue there.
Mm-hmm.
What about the physical therapy reports that do occur in 2007 that talk about the fact that she, you know, has had a little improvement, but she still walks with a limp, the assistance of the cane, she has decreased balance coordination, difficulty with activities of daily living. So even if you put Oris aside, how does the ALJ really conclude that she can walk or stand for 6 hours a day?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question because it sort of leads into the timeline I wanted to walk through. No one disputes that she had this this stroke in December of 2006, which, by the way, they also did a toxicology report at the same time, found that there was cocaine in her system, and advised her not to do any more cocaine. Mm-hmm. After that, she begins physical therapy, which she went to only twice. She's now using a walker. By June, when you get that last physical therapy report that talks about a long-term goal of her walking, you know, 4 or 5 blocks with a cane, she's using a cane. And then by her own testimony in December at the hearing, she says, oh, well, by September I was walking without a cane, I was walking without a walker, and sometimes when I had to walk long distances, I would put on a brace. So she's obviously recovered quite well within 7-8 months, not even the year's time that a person has to prove their disability. So even if you took her at her very worst state, you know, in January, February of 2007, before she's begun physical therapy, is still walking with a walker, that's a very limited amount of time and isn't the, you know, isn't the year's time that she needs to prove disability.
But I don't see, other than the ALJ's word for it, anything suggesting that she, that her leg weakness has improved significantly enough that she can stand and walk for at least 6 hours. You have this one crazy state agency medical consultant that the ALJ disregards, who thinks that she can perform medium work. And given the Social Security definitions of medium work, that's absurd. She probably never in her life could do that. So the ALJ puts that to one side. But then I just don't see the affirmative evidence with this 6 hours a day business.
Well, again, you know, these worst reports are coming in June of 2007.
But where's the positive case for it? Where has she ever, even if she can walk into the hearing without using a cane, that takes how long, 10 minutes? I mean, where do you extrapolate from 10 minutes to 6 hours?
Well, I'm also saying, I mean, based on her testimony at the hearing, she said, oh, yeah, I'm not walking without any, you know, I'm walking unaided at this point. Sometimes I use...
Can I walk for 6 hours? You know...
I don't think the amount of time is discussed.
But that's important for the RFC.
Well, I would also say that, you know, although the judge didn't have to, the judge also said, you know, I'm going to ask about sedentary jobs. And she did ask about sedentary jobs, and the VE provided, you know, numerous jobs that could be performed at a sedentary level. And furthermore, the judge went on to ask her, okay, well, can we talk about some gripping issues, too, with those sedentary jobs? And the VE said, no, you know, these jobs would not be precluded by any sort of making of fists and things like that. So, you know, this judge actually was very, very thorough. And although she didn't think to include aspects of sedentary limitations in the RFC, she certainly talked about them and asked about them of the VE. And then at the conclusion of her decision, added them, you know, to say, oh, by the way, in case maybe this RFC is too liberal, let's talk about some sedentary jobs. There are no further questions. I'd like to say that the commission would like to rest on the briefing now.
Okay. Anything further, Mr. Marvin?
Just a couple of things. One about the testimony and her not walking with a cane anymore. At the hearing, she testified that you know, she could stand and walk for maybe 5 to 10 minutes at a time before she would have to lean on something. So there was.
She didn't just say, "I'm fine," you know, "I'm running marathons."
Or no. She said she stopped using the cane. 5 to 10 minutes, she would lean on something, and he talked about her not using the cane on unless she had to go long distances. But she testified at the hearing also that the last time she had to walk a long distance, she walked 4 blocks. So that for her was a long distance. Second, about limitations in the hands. There was a lot of evidence from, you know, earlier in the record that she had the carpal tunnel syndrome and evidence of arthritis, and she complained about pain in the hands throughout. The ALJ seemed to rely on strength, the amount of strength she had in the hands, but didn't account for the pain she had. And the ALJ is required to consider all avenues that might relate to pain, and didn't consider whether that pain would be limiting also. That's all.
Okay, thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. I'll take the case under advisement.